everybody. I'm Juanita Wetzel, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. And I was told I can talk till 2 o'clock. And I know already you're armed with rocks, so I will quit it, too. Whoa, I took note of those rocks right away. Oh, boy. I'll quit shaking in a little bit. If you'll help me say my prayer. Just bow your heads and I'll do this praying. Lord, fill my mouth with real good stuff and nudge me when I've said enough. Okay. My dry date is February 4th, 1960. And that's 42 years, if you want to figure it up real quick. My age, I was born on February 29th, 1932, and I've only had 17 real birthdays, so you just figure that one out. My ninth baby was born one day before my 17th birthday, or whatever. I don't know. I can't remember. Anyway, she would have been born on my birthday if the doctor hadn't taken her right before it came. So anyway, I have 9 children, Bob and I do. I have 18 grandchildren. And I've been married 51 years and Bob's been married 39. I belong to Al-Anon. I'm a home group. My home group is 31W. Now, if you may think that's a crazy name for an Al-Anon group, but back in Kentucky, we kind of give names so we can give directions at the same time because we're a little slow, you know. And it happens to be located on Highway 31W, and that just seemed like a good name for a group since you had to find it on 31W. It's not my original home group. My original home group was Pleasure Ridge, and I liked that name, but it was on Friday night, and when we got busy in this program, we never could get there. We were always going out of town. And so you can't be a member of a group you can't go to. So we switched to a Sunday night. And we found that got to be difficult to go to. And then Bob's lungs got bad and we couldn't go to a smoking group. So we changed to 31W. And they graciously accepted us at that group. And so today that's my qualification. I have been in this program 42 and some odd years. And I'm an active member of that group. I have been an active member of my Al-Anon groups for 42 years. I attend meetings on a regular basis. Just because I come to these things, now I've never been to a 5-day deal. This has been wonderful and I am so excited and I don't have to get the spirit. I carry it with me all the time. But you people are really something. Boy, you know how to party. I tell you, it took Bob and I both to get this skirt on today. That woman over there in red is a garbage truck with teeth. I'm pointing to you, Carol. You people eat nonstop. I get up and I walk a distance and have to sit down and chew some more. Oh, Lord. I went back to our room and we'd gone out for something and come back and my Lord, there was 2 tables spread out with baskets and fruit and chewing stuff and chips and I've never seen anything like it. Have you all been in Texas? I've never seen anything like that. But Bob and I have done our best to chew our way through it. Whoa. I'm telling you, I've never seen anything like that. Usually it's this little basket of fruit with a great big grapefruit in the middle. I don't know what you're supposed to do with a grapefruit in a hotel room. But that's what you get. And I think we're not appreciative of that when we get it. We are. We really are. But we always need the grace transfer of the maid. But it's been wonderful. I tell you, just coming out here and getting to be with all of you all. And other than the speakers, we've not known anybody, and Barbara's kept saying, "Now that's so-and-so, do you know him?" And I go, "No." "And that's so-and-so, do you know him?" And I go, "No." And finally, yesterday, she said, "That's Betty Ann, do you know her?" And I said, "Yes, oh my God, I know somebody, isn't this wonderful?" It's been a thrill, it really has. I'm up here supposed to tell you, though, who I am and what I'm doing here and everything, and that's what I'm going to start trying to do. Oh, gosh. I walked through the doors of this AA meeting. I went into an AA meeting because Bob's already told you. He says I tricked him into that meeting, but I didn't. I just thought he was going to go fishing with his brother, and he ought to know something about what was wrong with his brother. And I was just looking out for his brother. I wasn't trying to trick him into a meeting. And neither one of us can figure out why we went to that meeting. But I knew that he was too far gone into alcoholism to get it, so I wanted to get back out there and get it for him. And so we did go to that Friday night meeting, and we climbed steps. I don't know why you always have to climb steps to get to your first meeting of any kind, but we had to climb those steps into that church, and we walked in that door to that meeting, and there was a lot of people in that room, and they were dressed really nice. Back in 1960, when you went into an AA group, the men were in suits and shirts and ties, and the women were dressed nice. And I was really impressed because I expected to see Skid Row bums. But they weren't. They were dressed really nice. And we got through the door, and I looked around, and boy, everybody looked good to me. And but there was, across the room, was this one gorgeous woman. I mean, she had red hair and legs from the floor up to her armpits. And she spied us, and she come running across the room, and she grabbed my brother-in-law, who was separated from his wife, and she kissed him. And I doubled up my fist, and I thought, "Don't reach for mine, sister." Now, I didn't want him, mind you. I hadn't wanted him for quite a while. But I wasn't going to give him to her. And you know, she didn't. She didn't reach for him. She just stuck her hand out. And she says, "You must be Norm's brother Bob." And I'm thinking, my God, he's been telling them about us. And I just stood there frozen. And she shook Bob's hand. And then she turns to me and she says, "Honey, are you going to stay down here with us drunks or go upstairs and learn how to live with your drunken husband?" Oh, my God, I almost died. Nobody called my husband a drunk. I called him every dirty name I could think of it behind closed doors, but nobody called my husband a drunk in public. But I wanted in that room. I knew they had something because Norman had gotten sober there. And I wanted in that room so bad I did what we non-alcoholics do best. I put my other face on, I smiled sweetly, and I said, "Oh, I'm going to stay here with him. He needs me." Now, he hadn't needed me for 2 years prior to that night, because there's 2 years and 9 months between Mary Rose and Missy. And that's the only separation in our kids. They were all born a year apart, because I had all 9 of them in 11 years. I was busy. Well, you want a big family, you got to get a job done quick. Anyway, so I stayed in that room, and I don't know how it happened, but Bob was back somewhere with his brother, and I was right on that front row. And this man gets up there and starts talking about his, and I don't know what he said at the beginning, but I heard this about his wonderful wife and how she had kept things together and put food on the table and kept those kids in school. And I just, oh, I'm telling you, all I could think of was I saw flags waving behind that man. I heard Onward Christian Soldiers music. And anything that could get my husband up in front of a room full of people to tell them how wonderful I was what I was going to get for that man or die trying. And God knows I almost did die trying. Because I went back to AA meetings. Now, Bob didn't get a thing out of that meeting. And I knew why. I knew his brain was already squashed. So they talked about brain damage in that meeting. They really did, and I knew he had it. So I was going to get it for him. And I got one of them directories. And boy, I started making rounds of those AA meetings. And I'd just go in and sit down and listen. And people would ask me my name, and I'd tell them. Nobody ever asked me if I was an alcoholic, and I didn't volunteer anything. So I just sat in those AA meetings, and I found a lot out. I found out what he'd been doing out there. I had suspected it, but boy, now I had proof. I was listening real good. And I kept going. I went back to this Friday night meeting that my brother-in-law went to, and one night I got there, and two gray-headed old ladies. Well, I got to be careful. I'm older than they were then. But they came in and they said, we're going to start a real Al-Anon meeting here, and we want you to go with us tonight. And I said, oh, no, I'm not going to any auxiliaries. Uh-uh. I said, I'm just here so I can get him here and get him sober. And they said, honey, you don't belong here. This is for the alcoholics. And if you come with us, we'll help you. Well, I thought they meant getting sober, so I went like a lamb to slaughter. I got up there in that room, and there were three men. I didn't know Al-Anon men were rare and for many years, because those three men were really active in that little group. And there were these two gray-headed ladies and one other girl and me. And they started me, they opened it up, I'm reading all this stuff, and I didn't pay attention to that except that I'm powerless over alcohol, and I thought, no, I'm not, I don't even drink the stuff. And none of that made sense to me, so I didn't pay attention to it. And then they said, we're going to have a little discussion, and we're going to talk about character defects. I didn't have any, so I wasn't going to participate in that either. Now, going back just a little bit, I can tell you that I called him an SOB one night, not using initials, and he reacted to me, and he said, don't you ever call me that again. That's not cursing me, that's cursing my mother. Well, God knows I wanted to curse her. She'd raised two of them, and it had to be her fault, so I used that word a lot, because, you see, I wanted to get a reaction out of him. I don't know how anybody else in this room felt about their alcoholic, but I wanted that man to fight. I needed a fight. I had all this frustration and anger built up inside of me, and I wanted a fight. And when he'd come home, he just wanted to pass out quietly, and that was it. I had been storing up all day what I was going to say to him. I'd been rehearsing. I even had a script written. I was going to say this, and he was supposed to answer that, and then we would be into it, you know. And he never knew his part in that play. And I would just be so frustrated, I would just go to pieces. And one time I even went back. I couldn't rouse him in any way, shape, or form, so I went out and filled a pitcher full of ice water, went back and poured it on him in my bed. And it revived him. Revived him really good. And he got up and got dressed again and went back out to get drunker. And I had to change the bed and try to dry the mattress out and turn the darn thing over. And you know, I had all that work to do. But fortunately, I was dead tired, so I laid down on the clean side of the mattress and went to sleep. But that's how crazy I was. I had this frustration just building and building and building. And so I was the crazy one in that house. My children never knew when they came in the house whether I was going to kiss them or kill them. They never knew when I raised my hand, whether I was going to pat them or smack them. They never knew. When they talked in later meetings about, you know, with the children, I've heard people say that the children didn't ask their friends home because they were ashamed that they're drunk and alcoholic. No, my children never asked anybody to our house because they didn't know whether that they could come in the door and I'd be screaming at them. I was the reason they never had anybody at the house, because I might be tearing their room up and dumping their stuff in the middle of the floor saying, you will keep your drawers straight or I will tear the stuff up and throw it away. I was the wild one. And this is the person that's still going to these meetings. Now, when they asked me to share that thing, I couldn't share anything, and I wasn't about to, so I passed. And sat there like a bump on a log through these Al-Anon meetings, and then raced downstairs as soon as the meeting was over so I could help with the cups. They, you know, back in those days, they didn't even have styrofoam cups. They used the church's cups, and we washed them and dried them and put them back up in the cabinets of the church. And I got in that kitchen and volunteered to help. I was in the service real early, didn't even know it. But I was back there, and then I would talk to those alcoholics, and they'd listen to me. And that was the biggest help I ever had, was somebody to listen to me. And when I would get through, they'd say, oh, honey, you keep coming back. It will work. It really will work for you. And then I'd get to go to some of the open meetings, and I'd hear these alcoholics talking. I must have gotten real transparent about this because, you see, whatever the AA said happened to create his bottom and he got sober on it, happened to Bob the next day. Because they told me he would have to hit his bottom. And I kept saying, what's the bottom? And they said, it's when he has a crisis in his life. And when that crisis happens, he'll know it and he'll get sober. So I listened for your crisis, and whatever it was, became his crisis the next day. And one night, this couple came from Owensboro to Louisville, and she said that she had hit her husband in the head with a cast iron skillet, and when he came to in the hospital, he called AA. And, you're ahead of me. Saturday morning, I was in the Winn-Dixie buying cast iron skillets. I bought a round one and a square one. And I'm running down to the checkout line, and this same beautiful red-headed lady that has been there that first night, she grabbed me by the arm, and she says, I have run down 3 aisles. She says, my God, didn't you hear me hollering? Well, I don't know about you, but I had two parts to my brain. The one that smiled and said hello, you know, and went on. And this back here that was going, where is he, what's he doing, and how much is he spending, and all this, you know, just wheels just running. And all of those had taken over. Boy, there wasn't anything up here doing anything. And I was just on that beeline to get those skillets and get home and get that job done, get him in the hospital. And she grabbed my arm and she looked down in the cart and she says, oh, no. And I said, oh, yes. And she says, you're going home with me. And I said, oh, no. And she says, oh, yes. And so I bought the skillets. And I got them in the car, but she got me in her car, and we went to her house. And she put the coffee pot on. And this beautiful AA lady did what you alcoholics do every time you 12-step somebody. She sat there and shared her story with me. And this beautiful woman belonged to the same church we did, and I had seen this woman drunk. I knew her children. I knew their pain because I'd seen them when she had come out of the church and fallen off the steps and was upside down in one of the big shrubs. You know, she didn't want to do that, and when she told me she didn't want to do it, I believed her. You know, I could believe this woman, alcoholic, when she said she didn't want to do that and shame her children. She didn't want to be down in that bar with her husband out looking for her. And when I made the statement, I said, you know, if I was down in that bar, I'd be having fun. And she says, yeah, but you're not an alcoholic. Can you believe me when I tell you, when I was down at that piano bar, that I was more alone than if I'd been on an iceberg in Alaska? And I looked into her eyes and I said, yes, I can believe you. And she said, then can you believe me that your husband feels like that? And I said, no. And she said, well, then try to believe me that I can, when I tell you he is. And I tried. I really did. And then she said, and can you believe how lonely that we feel? And I said, no. And she says, there is nothing as lonely as an alcoholic when they're even in a crowd. And I said, I find that hard to believe. And I said, because I don't think you know the loneliness of being back in that house all by myself with nothing but these little people around my knees. No one to talk to. I can't tell my friends what I've done, but they don't want them to know what a miserable choice I made in my life. I can't tell my parents, they'll kill him. And I can't tell his parents, they don't want to hear it. I said, there's no one I can talk to. I am all alone back there in that house. It's a loneliness that I don't think even you can understand. And she says, that's true. Maybe I can't understand yours. But you sit in a room two or three nights a week. I know you go to the Al-Anon rooms. Why don't you share with those people? You don't open your mouth. You sit there and pass every time it comes around to you. And I said, I'm afraid to talk to them. If they knew what I do in that house, and they knew the kind of person I am, they wouldn't let me come back. And she says, why don't you give them a chance? They've probably done the same things too. And I couldn't believe that. So I went home. And I didn't do anything about it. I kept going to those meetings, but I couldn't talk to those people. Because I was afraid if they knew the awful things I was still doing. You see, I was the violent one. Bob never laid a hand on me. But I wish I could say that. You see, I wanted him to feel the pain that I was feeling. I had this knot right here I couldn't swallow past. It hurt so bad. And I wanted him to feel that pain. And the only way I could knew how to do it was to hurt him. I used to do terrible things. We had a door to our bedroom. It was really a wonderful door for Al-Anon. And you could station it just so that if somebody tried to walk down that hall in the dark, they would get a really wonderful streak down their face. And there were times when Bob looked like he'd been in prison, the bars down his face, because I would station it just right and he would be just drunk enough to forget the door would be there. And if he made it past the door and got into the bed, I would wait till I was sure he was out, and then I would brace my feet in the small of his back and shove. And his whole body would hit the floor. And he would jump up and go, oh, what happened? And I would say, you're drunk, you fell out of bed. And he would apologize. And I'd say, that's all right, just don't let it happen again. I was a really bad person. I'm only going to tell you one more of my bad stories and I'm going to get on. We played lots of games. We played hide and go seek with these billfolds. He hit it. We went to seek it. And when I say we, my children are really, really small, but they know how to play. And I would get them up. I'd say, Daddy healed the billfold. Let's go find it. At 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And they get up and say, oh, boy, and off we go. We would find the billfold. And when we found the billfold, we took all the money out. Now, he was in real estate business, and, you know, a lot of that money was escrow money. But we didn't care. If we found it, finders keepers. So, we survived like that. I don't know what he did. But That's how we did it. So one night, and we also played King on the Hill with the car keys, because we only had one car. And so if I had the keys, I was king that night, and he didn't get to go out to drink. I don't know why I thought that was fun, because it was no fun in that house. We were there so, you know, not just barely drunk and wanting to leave. He made life miserable for us, but I had this power, you know, and boy, did we Al-Anons love power. And so one night, and this is in Al-Anon, I'm going to meetings, but I'm not listening to anything because I have not even paid attention to those steps. All I want is him sober. And so I've got the keys, and he's not going to drink, and I'm not going to get to go to a meeting, but that's okay. I've got the keys. And I'm holding them clutched as tight as I can. And, of course, I'm always pregnant, so I was pregnant. And I'm clutching the keys, and I've got them like this. And I don't know, and he doesn't know, and we're not real sure. We've talked about it a couple of times, and we still don't know. But he did something, and my arm went like this, and I followed it. I did a flip and ended up on the floor in the living room, flat, just a complete flip, and he had the keys. But I'm sitting there. Now, my concern was not for my health or whether I had hurt the baby or anything. The only thing was this feeling just washed over me, and I put my hands on my hips, sitting there, laying there on the floor practically, and I said, well, you have finally sunk as low as a man can sink. You have struck a lady. And he looked around our living room and he said, I don't see any lady. Well, I'm Irish and I used to have red hair before he wanted a blonde for Christmas. And that was in sobriety that he wanted the blonde. Anyway, I came up off that floor with the worst anger, the rage just up like molten lava through me. I come up off that floor, and the only thing that within reach was the fireplace equipment set. And I grabbed the poker, and I swung that poker at his head. I mean, I brought it down with every ounce of strength I had in my body. I wanted to kill him. I brought that poker down on his head, and he threw his arm up, and I broke his arm. It was obvious I broke his arm. It was really bent in a weird shape. And he started dancing around the living room and screaming, "You broke my arm!" And I laid the poker down very carefully in the set. All the rage was gone. All the anger was gone. I was fine. I took a deep breath and I said, "I wish it had been your head." And he said, "Take me to the hospital." And I just said, "No. You could die, damn you. I don't care. You have to take yourself to the hospital." And with that, you know, the keys were there at his disposal. He could go if he wanted to. I don't really know. I know I had to have been totally insane in that instant. And I just turned and walked away and went about my business. And he did. He picked up the keys and he went in, left in the car. And when he came back, they couldn't do anything about the brake because his arm had swollen enormously. And they had it in a sling, and he would sit across the table from me, and he'd say, "Look what you did." And I'd say, "I wish it had been your head." I had no remorse for that. I never did. And 6 years later, I was on a retreat, one of those serenity retreats with Father Fred, and I said, "Why have I never felt any remorse for doing that?" And he said, "Well, some of us are sicker than others." And in your case, he says, "I guess you were sicker than most." And I said, "Well, I make it up to him every day because I have never found it necessary to take a poker and hit him in the head." Since I really got into Al-Anon, I've never, ever raised my hand to strike or hit my husband in any way, or even my children. I quit that too. But that's the end of my horrible story, because we came to a place in our marriage that I found it necessary. I filed suit for divorce a lot. I used to work for an attorney, and I would go back to work for him off and on and do, you know, after-hours work for him to type and do all that to earn a little extra money. But I filed suit for divorce a lot to scare him sober. It didn't work. It was scare him sober for a week or 10 days. Because he'd say, "What do you want?" And I'd say, "I want you to quit drinking." And he'd say, "That's all you want, I'll quit." And he would for a week or 10 days. But it got to the point where one day our children were, the oldest one was in the fourth grade, and I went up to school, and she was actually failing in school, and she's an excellent student. And I said to the teacher, "What do you mean she's failing? She's an excellent student. She's smart." And she says, "Well, you know, Miss Wesso," she says, "she sits and cries. She looks out the window and cries." And I said, "What?" And she says, "I've asked her what's wrong a dozen times," and she says, "Nothing, nothing." And she says, "I'm upset." And then she'll go back and try to do her work. She says, "You know, my dad was an alcoholic." And she says, "And she acts just like I did." And I said, "Your father was an alcoholic?" And she says, "Yeah." And she says, "You know," she says, "I hated my mother." And I said, "Your dad was an alcoholic and you hated your mother?" And she says, "Yeah, my mother made us live in that mess." She says, "And I hated her for it." And she says, "And I acted just like Cindy. I'd be sitting in school and just burst into tears when I think of having to go home to that mess." And I said, "Well, I'm so sorry for your life." I said, "I really am." Got up and walked out of that school because I had a babysitter. I just kept going. Drove on downtown, went into the lawyer's office that I worked for, and I told the receptionist, I said, "I have to see him just 1 minute. Just give me 1 minute with him." And I just opened his door and I said, file for the door and through with it. And he did. And Bob got the papers, and when he got served with the papers, any time he was ever served with anything, he had to do something. Any time he was served with anything, or had a problem, he goes fishing to think about it. So when I saw him packing up everything, I knew that that's where he was going, was fishing. And so when he left the house, he packed up the trunk of the car, and he didn't even bother to make me a promise this time. He was gone. He really piled the car up full of a lot of stuff. And I believed he was gone forever. I thought I'd never see him again. I wasn't that lucky. By this time, we were living with my mother, and oh, it was really fun to have three bosses in that house. My mother hated him. My dad had hated him before he died. They begged me not to marry him, but, you know, when parents object to you marrying and liking somebody, that's the worst thing that they can do. Believe me, if your kid doesn't, if you don't like who your kid's dating, turn this thing around. Start liking him. Then they don't have to defend him anymore, and they'll take a good look at him. I had to defend Bob a lot, so I married him. He was gone. My mother had the locks changed on the house. She had a warrant taken out so that if he stepped on her property, she could have him arrested. So it was just very uncomfortable. Every morning when I had to ask her for the kids' lunch money, as she dropped the money in my hand for each child, she would say, "Repeat after me, I will not take him back." I'm pregnant with the eighth child. And I would say, "I will not take him back, Mother." And then she dropped the next kid's lunch money. "I will not take him back." I said, "I will not take him back, Mother." This is every morning. And so for 3 weeks, that's how we lived. Then one morning, I looked out, and there stood Bob at the back door. And I said, "Go away. I will not take you back." And he said, "My key doesn't fit the lock." And I said, "Mother had the locks changed. Go away." And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I want you to quit drinking, but go away now." And he said, "I would rather be dead than face a life without drinking." And I believed him. I knew he meant it. And he turned and walked away. And again, I thought I would never see him again. And so that was my home group night. I was getting dressed to go in my home group, the Pledge of Age group. And I heard a crash. And when I heard that crash, when you have 7 or 8 children, you move real quickly because a crash would mean something really scary. So I raced down the steps. When I got down to the bottom of the steps, there the side door of the house is laying down flat on the ground. My mother's on one end of it and my husband's on the other, and they're screaming at each other. And I just turned around and went back upstairs because it was not my problem. And I had enough Al-Anon to know that. So I went back upstairs and going on to finish getting dressed. And the next thing I hear is my children screaming. So I go out, and Cindy's heard and her little brothers and sisters. Cindy's 9 years old, and there are 6 little brothers and sisters. And the baby's 18 months old. And she's got them all herded going up the steps. And I said, "What is going on?" And she says, "Daddy's got a gun and says he's going to kill somebody." And I said, "Honey, your daddy's not going to kill anybody." And she says, "Well, he just went up in the attic with his shotgun." And I said, "Oh." And I opened up the door to stare up the barrel of the shotgun. And I said, "What are you doing?" And his sweetest voice you've ever heard, he said, "Honey, your mother wants to have the police arrest me. You can't live with that shame of kids. We've been gone for 3 weeks. And you don't even know whether we've been eating or not." And I said, "Okay." And I backed away and shut the door. And I went downstairs and I got to the bottom of the steps, and there's my mother with her 410 shotgun. And I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm going upstairs and get rid of the problem." And, you know, a lot of things can flash real fast. And for just a second, I'm an only child. My mother, with all the family I had left in the world, my daddy died 2 years previous to this. For just a second, I thought, you know, if I let her go and they kill each other, the kids and I could live in peace. But a lazy bit of sanity washed over me. And I put my arm across the stairwell and I said, "No, give me the gun, Mother." And she said, "No." And I had my hand across the rail and I had my hand on the gun. And this was the precise moment that the police chose to arrive that my mother had called because he wouldn't go. And they looked in the door, and it was a warm November night in Louisville. And we just had the screen doors, so they looked in the doors, the two women struggling over a gun, and they called out the riot squad before they knew the nut was in the attic. So we're surrounded by police cars. We live on a hill. We have a driveway on this side and across the back. We have a street in the front and a street on the side. So they had police cars all around us, lights on the house. The sirens were still going around, whoop, 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 like that. And they're everywhere. The house used to have real big trees all around it, but Lightning and Bob have gotten rid of most of them. And they had policemen behind the trees with tear gas guns. I had never seen a tear gas gun, and the first one I saw scared me to death. And so I opened the front door and looked out, and I didn't see the police at first, and so I said to the trees, "Is it okay if I call AA?" And one of the trees said, "Well, hell, lady, we don't care who you call." So I just went back in and picked up the phone, and I called the church that I would have been at if I could have gotten out of the house. And they answered the phone, and I mentally thought this is weird because the phone's locked up in the pastor's office. But anyway, they answered the phone, and I said, I asked for Norman. And so my brother-in-law came to the phone, and I said, told him what was going on. And Norman and a priest and 2 AA members came to our house that night. And Norman went up to get Bob to give up his gun. And the priest went out and talked to the police and got them to leave, and it took both AA members to get my mother to give up the gun. They got her to take one of her sleeping pills and put her to bed. And then the NAMI and the AA members got Bob to get in the car with them, and they told me they were taking him to Our Lady of Peace, and I said, we don't have any insurance or money. And they said, we'll take care of it, and evidently they did. I never did know how, and don't care today. The fact they are. And I was left there in the house alone. And I still had the telephone in my lap, and I still was half-dressed. I had a sweater and pearls and a slip and a robe. And so I went upstairs to the bedroom, and I stood there looking out the window. And I thought, I've been going to meetings for 2 years and 9 months, and I have been trying to do this thing the way they were telling me. I took everybody's advice on what to do, except I never took anything out of the online program except the serenity prayer. I did finally understand that. I thought that was the stupidest prayer I'd ever heard in my life. How do you know you can't change it until you've tried? I mean, you know, that just didn't make sense. If you haven't tried to change it, how do you know you can't? And then one day, our Buddhist from Texas came up to there in Louisville and talked, and she hit the podium and said, I am powerless over persons, places, things, and circumstances. The only thing I can change is my attitude. And I went, my God, she just explained the strength of prayer. And she had, but I needed somebody with a sudden drawl to tell me. So that's about all I had learned about Al-Anon until that night. But I have had this mean old gray-headed lady follow me around Al-Anon telling everybody she was my sponsor, and I'd follow right behind her and say, no, she's not. And I would choose somebody else, some sweet, gentle soul, because I could browbeat them. But this old lady kept telling everybody she was my sponsor. And you know, for 28 years she told people she was my sponsor. And I finally gave up and let her have a job right before she died. But she was cruel to me. She never said a kind word to me. And, you know, she really was a tough old bird. She loved him, and she was so sweet to him. She just talked soft and gentle to him, and she just talked like a sergeant in the army to me. And you just don't give a lady like that much room. You try to stay away from her. But she was good for me. She was just what I needed because she made me think. I hung up on her a lot, but she did make me think. So she was just what I needed. But this is where I was that night. I had done nothing about myself. You see, I was still praying, God, thank you, get sober today. And when I went to bed that night, I'd say, God, you didn't do so good today. I'll give you one more chance tomorrow. And then I'd wake up and I'd go to Mass every morning. I was so religious. Oh, Lord, I went to Mass every day. And I went there to tell God how to run today. And then I went back the next day and said, well, you didn't do so good yesterday, but I'll give you another chance today. And that's how my religion went. I recited prayers. I never prayed one. But that night, I just laid it all out. I said, God, this is what all I've done for you. And you've not done anything for me. I've done all of this. And then I just knelt down and I could hear this old lady saying, if you don't feel close to God, if you despair that God's there, that's the sin you can commit. That's practically the only sin that you can really commit, is when you despair of God's love, because God's love is there. But he's too much of a gentleman to push himself into your life. You have to open your heart and invite him in. And so the prayers are wrong, which is how I learned every lesson I've ever learned in this program. I opened my heart and I invited him in, and I said the first prayer I'd ever prayed in my life. I said, God, please help me. I didn't add anything on help me pay a bill, help me get him sober, help me do it. I just stopped with, please help me. And I felt like somebody poured one molasses over me. I really felt like I had just been wrapped up in something really warm. And I know today that was the moment that I had let go and let God. And I laid down across the bed and went sound asleep. When the alarm clock went off, I was terrified because I had no knowledge of where my seven children were. None. I only remember seeing them when they said, "Daddy's in the attic." I raced back through the rooms where beds hadn't been slept in. And I couldn't think. And I just wondered, did they go to a neighbor's? Where would they be? And I happened to look into the larger bedroom, and the closet door was shut. And I thought, the kids never shut a door of any kind. And I went running over to the door, and I shook the doorknob. The door was locked. And I shook it, and Cindy's little voice says, and I did say Cindy, and her little voice says, "Mama, are you all right?" And I said, "Open the door." And the little key turned in the lock. She had gotten a chair and gotten the skeleton key off the top of the door and put her six little brothers and sisters in that closet with some pillows and blankets. Our children had spent the night in that closet, terrified. The two people with guns might kill them. And because Bob had stayed in his program and stayed sober from that night to this, we've never had it. Our children have never had a night like that in their life since. And it's all that the program gave us. That would be more than enough for us. But it isn't all that this program's given us. God has been so good to us. Because we went on to have two sober babies. Our children were raised in Alateen, all nine of them. They went to Alateen, they went to Alatot, the younger ones. The three youngest never saw their dad take a drink. The older ones really benefited from Alateen. Our oldest daughter, Cindy, was actually the one that people invited. Bob and I rode on her coattail for a lot of years. They'd invite Cindy to talk and take us because they wanted to get Cindy as a speaker. I spoke as a family. We started in 1967 at the Desert Roundup out here. And went to Elsa Faye and Mari and that bunch of women out there. It was a real wonderful experience for us. And when Cindy grew up, and we kind of dropped us. But we have been so blessed. when Bob got out of the hospital, he didn't automatically say, "Oh, I found the light and I'm going to go to AA," but he did come home, and the baby came out of the hospital and came back to the house. I told him, "Go away. My mother still has everything going. You can't come in this house." And he said to me through the door, he said, "I have been talking to your mother." And I thought, "Yeah, right." And he says, "And she said that if it's okay with you, that I can stay tonight and eat dinner with," because it was our second oldest daughter's birthday, "and I can stay for dinner for Pam's birthday." And I said, "My mother said that?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Okay," so I unlocked the door and let him in. And of course the kids were excited to see him, and Pam was ecstatic because she was a daddy's girl. And so I was supposed to talk that night at an Al-Anon meeting, and it was from release with love. And I'm thinking, oh boy. Now Bob had always been telling me, he'd say, "Why are you treating me like this?" And I'd say, "I'm releasing you with love." And he says, "It looks more like rejection to me." But so I went over, and I'm looking at my husband and my mother. I'd finished the dishes, and I'm thinking, "I'll just call and tell them I can't do it. I can't go out, and I'll stay here and keep them from killing each other." And then I'm thinking, no, I've made a commitment, and I'm going to go. And so that's what I did. I just announced to mother that I had made this commitment, and I was going to go. I had to get a babysitter, though, to do this. I had to pay a babysitter to come in and take care of my children, even when my mother was in the house, because she would not babysit for me to go to Al-Anon. She hated Al-Anon, and she hated it till the very day she died. She would not babysit so I could go. she thought that everything I did to my husband was right. That's what you ought to do when they're drunk. And so she hated Al-Anon. But the bottom line is that I had a babysitter coming, and I went to that Al-Anon meeting. I don't know what kind of talk I gave, because the back of my head was going, oh my God, if they killed each other, dead, I hope the kids got out of the way, the line of fire, and all of these things. But anyway, I did go. When I came back, the babysitter was gone. My mother and my husband were sitting at the breakfast room table, and they were drinking coffee. And I walked in, and my mother says, sit down. And I sat. And she says, it wants to stay. And I said, oh. And Bob says, before you say anything, let me say something. And I said, okay, because I didn't know what to say. And he reached across the table and he took my hand. And he says, before you say anything at all, let me say this. I can't promise you that I will never drink, because I don't know that. I can't promise you anything except that I don't want to go back to the hell we've been living in. I can only promise you one day at a time that I will try. And the whole world just lifted off my shoulders because he was talking AA. And I just let a big sigh out and I said, then you can stay, because that's all you can promise me. Because Bill had told me a long time ago that if I could write Bob a promise that he'd be alive for a year, then Bob might be able to promise me he wouldn't do for a year. And I said, you know I can't write him a promise that he'll be alive for a year. And he says, well, he can't promise you he'll be sober for a year. You can just do it one day at a time, honey. And that's what Bob was telling me. He could just do it one day at a time, and I believed it, because I had listened to that. And so that's how we started, one day at a time. He was going to stay sober, and I was going to live with him. And that's what we've been doing. And we renew our marriage vows one year at a time. We don't stay married forever. We just get married one year at a time. We renew our vows each year. And so, like I said, that's how we do it. I stayed active in service work. I worked very hard. Back when I could have gone for delegate, I had 9 children who desperately needed a mom to go to their games and be there for them, to take them to practice. And when you have 9 of them, you really have to be someplace all the time. And I chose not to do that. I was I went as high as alternate delegate, and that was as high as I could really do it. I'm back in service work again. I had about 8 years when I just really pushed all of the people I sponsored into service work. I started the step study when the Paths to Recovery came out. I said, oh, this is good. I've been wanting to do something. I'm going to start a step study, this Paths to Recovery study book. We're going to do this. And 3 years ago, we started it with about 7 people. And today, it's really growing fast. And we started out going through the book, one page at a time. Big mistake. We lost everybody when we got to the concepts. Nobody wanted to study the concepts. So now we do a step, a tradition, and a concept. Then we do second step, second tradition, and second concept. And that works beautifully. We keep our crowd. We've really done well. We're in the 3rd and a half year now, so we're really going strong. But because we didn't have a lot of money at first, we couldn't send anybody and pay their way, I said, I'll be the new GR. So I've gone back as a GR, and I've enjoyed these 3 years, and now it's time for election, and I believe in rotation. So that's part of the growing in this thing. I believe that my Al-Anon has stayed good and strong because I have been adhering to the principles of my program all these years. I believe that I don't have a right to stand up at this podium unless I am attending meetings. I believe that I need to have a home group, and I need to be active in my home group. I believe that I need to be active in service, even if it's just getting the literature out on the table and sharing meetings in my home group. I'm also the treasurer of my home group and GR of the study group. I work real hard. I'm always into something. My district is the most active district group in my whole state. We took on a mini conference the year of our birthday, the 50th birthday, and we did such a bang-up job you wouldn't believe it. I mean, our little district only has 12 active groups, and yet we put on a mini conference that brought in 800 people, and we made, oh, good $2. I tell you, we got people to donate stuff they didn't know they had. And we took food off their tables to finish the breakfast and the lunch and the dinner. We are really, I mean, we just are go-getters and hard workers. And I think you people are just about to outdo us out here on a bigger level. But we're just a tiny little segment there in Kentucky, but we really work hard. We're busy, busy, busy people. And we love it that way. And I think that's why, but you know, getting the spirit here is just wonderful. I love you people, and it's been so exciting. And I'm getting really close to the time I'm going to have to say goodbye. Y'all are just wonderful. I love you so much. And if I haven't given you an idea that even at this time, that my Al-Anon is as new and as fresh to me, because you know, Bob and I go to a lot of these things. Now it isn't that we don't just go to the ones we talk at. We go to everything that's in our state. If the only ones we miss in our state is if we've accidentally booked ourselves someplace else at the same time. That we hate to do, and we don't do it if we know that we've got a state thing. Because we have to fill it's like going to a filling station and filling our bucket. We have to have a filling station. We couldn't just go to things that we talk at, because think how empty we'd be if we did that. We have to go and fill our buckets, and boy, have we gotten our buckets filled this weekend. Oh, I tell you, the speaker last night, even when he tried to laugh, I wept for his laughter, because he touched me from the bottom of my heart. And Debbie, oh my gosh, did you ever tear me up? I'm not gonna single anybody else out. I'm sorry, I can't do that. Because I'm gonna start crying, and I don't want to do that. I really don't. I'm trying real hard to maintain my I don't want to cry. I look ugly when I cry. My nose is red. And my mascara went all down my face. I'm going to be good. And it's, oh my gosh, it's rock bottom pants. If I haven't told you, anybody here today, that I'm as enthusiastic today about my Al-Anon program as I was the day that I realized that Al-Anon was the thing that was going to save my life, then I had failed completely at the business of being an Al-Anon member. I love you. I love everything about you. And you alcoholics, I'm so grateful to you that you shared your 12 steps with us. You were so generous in sharing your disease with us. It was the least you could do. And I'm so grateful that if my husband had to have an incurable disease, that this is the one he's got. There are so many others that are so terminal. This is one that's treated by going to meetings and meeting wonderful people like you. And oh, thank God we get to meet wonderful people like you. And I thank you, Barbara and Frank. God love you. I do thank you, Barbara, that you didn't tell. Oh, goodness. Thank you, Lynn, for all the wonderful phone calls and everything. And thank you for all that gravy food. I'll go on a diet when I get home. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. God love you.